Aye.
Joria Conal slapped his gloved hands together over a fire which seemed reluctant to burn.
The Foy Miore are fitting cousins to the Lords of Entropy, for they seem to seek the same ends. For all I know, the Foy Miore are what those lords have become. There are so many fluctuations these days, caused partially, I should say, by Baron Callan's foolish manipulation of time, partially as the result of the million spheres beginning to slide out of conjunction, though that will take a little while before it's fully accomplished. In the meantime, we live in times which are uncertain in more ways than one. The fate of sentient life itself sometimes seems to me to be at stake. Yet do I fear? No, I think not. I place no special value upon sentience. I'd as cheerfully become a tree.
Coram smiled as he set a pan upon the fire and began to lay strips of meat in the slowly boiling water.
Who's to say that trees are not sentient?
Well, then, a block of marble.
Again, we do not know.
I'll not play such children's games.
You misunderstand me. You have touched on a subject I have been considering only lately. You see, I too am beginning to realize that there is no special value to being, as it were, able to think. Indeed, one can see many disadvantages. The whole condition of mortals is created by their ability to analyze the universe and their inability to understand it.
Some do not care. I, for one, am content to drift, to let whatever happens happen without bothering to ask why it happens.
Indeed, I agree that it is an admirable feeling. But we are not all endowed with such feelings by nature. Some must cultivate those feelings. Others may never cultivate them, and they lead unhappy lives as a result. Yet does it matter if our lives are happy or unhappy? Should we place more value on joy than on sorrow? Is it not possible to see both as possessing the same value?
All I know is that most of us consider it better to be happy.
Yet we all achieve that happiness in a variety of ways. Some by cultivating carelessness, some by caring, some by service to themselves, and some by service to others. Currently, I find pleasure in serving others. The whole question of morality
is as nothing when one's stomach rumbles.
Jari peered into the pan.
Is that meat done, do you think, Coram?
I think I am becoming a bore.
It's nothing.
Jari fished pieces of meat from the pan and dropped them into his bowl. He set one piece aside to cool for the cat, which sat on his shoulder and rubbed its head against Jari's.
You have found a religion, that is all. What else can you expect in a Mabden dream?
After Coram, Jari, and Whiskers were sated, they continued their journey. They rode beside a frozen river, along a track now completely hidden by snow, climbing higher and higher into the hills. They rode past a house whose stone walls had been cracked open as if by the blow of a gigantic hammer, and it was only when they were close did they see the white skulls peering from the windows and the white hands gesturing in attitudes of terror. The bones shimmered in the pale sunshine.
Frozen, and cold it was which doubtless cracked the stones.
Balar's work. He of the single deadly eye. I know him. I have fought him.
They went past the house and over the hill, and they found a town where the frozen corpses lay strewn about, and these still had flesh on them, and had plainly died before the cold had frozen them, and each male had been horribly desecrated.
The work of Goem, the only female of the Foy Miore still surviving. She has a taste for certain morsels of mortal flesh.
Joria Conal pointed ahead to where grey cloud boiled.
We are at the borders of the lands where the Foy Miore hold full sway. Shall we suffer so? Shall Bala or Goem find us?
It is possible, Jari.
You are most sober, old friend. Well, console yourself that if they do these things to us, we shall remain in a position of moral superiority.
It does console me.
And they led their horses out of the town and down a steep, snow-filled track, passing a cart full of the frozen bodies of children, doubtless sent to flee the place before the Foy Miore descended. And they entered a valley where the bodies of a whole army of warriors had been eaten by dogs. And here they found fresh tracks, the tracks of a single rider and three large hounds.
Gaynor also goes this way, a mere few hours ahead of us. Why does he dally now?
Perhaps he watches us. Perhaps he tries to guess the purpose of our quest. With such information, he can return to his masters and be welcomed.
If the Foimiore welcome anyone, they do not recruit help as such. There are some, the resurrected dead among them, who have no choice but to follow them and do their work for them, for they are welcome nowhere else.
How do the Foimiore resurrect the dead?
There is one of the six called Rannan, I believe. Rannan breathes cold breath into the mouths of the dead and brings them to life. He kisses the living and introduces them to death. And that is the legend. But few know of the Foimiore. Even the Foimiore hardly know what they do or why they are upon this plane. Once they were driven away by the Shi, who came from another plane themselves to help the people of Lumenesh. But with the decline of the Shi, the Foimiore's strength grew unchecked until they were able to return to the land and begin their conquerings. Their diseases must kill them soon. Few, I understand, will live for more than another 1,000 years. Then, when the Foimiore die, the whole of this world shall be dead.
It would seem that we could do with a few Shi allies.
The only one I know is called Gofanin, and he is weary of fighting. He accepts that the world is doomed, and that nothing he can do will avert that doom.
Jari feelingly looked about him.
He could be right.
Coram lifted his head, peering this way and that, his face troubled. He looked up into the hills from which they had come.
What is it?
Do you not hear it?
Who would play music here, save a dirge? And it sounds as if it could be a dirge.
Aye, a dirge for me. I have heard the harp more than once since I came to this realm, Jari, and I have been told to fear a harp.
It is beautiful, however.
I have been told to fear beauty also. I still cannot find the source of the music.
Coram realized that he was trembling, and he controlled himself, urging his horse onward.
I have been told that I shall be slain by a brother.
You never told me you had a brother, Coram.
I do not.
Then what does it mean?
I know not.
Who told you such a thing? And this troubles you, does it not, Coram? I can tell it troubles you whether you say so or no. A brother. Could it mean a friend, do you think? Or perhaps another Vada? One that still manages to live in this time? Very well, then.
They rode for some miles in silence until they came out of the valley and looked upon a wide plain.
The plain of Craig Doan. That is all it can be. This is thought a holy place by the Mabden. We are more than halfway to Caer Lud now, I think.
And well into the lands of the Foimiore.
Even as they watched, a blizzard swept suddenly over the great plain from east to west, leaving fresh snow sparkling as a woman might lay a fresh sheet upon a bed.
We'll leave good tracks in that.
Coram was marveling at the strange sight as the fast-moving blizzard moved away into the distance. Overhead, the sun was fully obscured by clouds. The clouds were agitated. They swirled restlessly all the time, changing shape swiftly.
I am reminded somewhat of the realm of chaos, and I have been told that such frozen landscapes as these are the ultimate landscapes of worlds where the lords of entropy are triumphant. This is what their wasteful variety achieves. But I speak of other worlds and other heroes, indeed of other dreams. Shall we risk the dangers of detection upon that plain, or shall we circle the plain and hope that we are not seen?
We cross the plain of Craig Doan, and if we are stopped and have time to speak, we shall say that we have come to offer our services to the Foimiore, knowing that the Mabden cause is hopeless.
There seem few here of any intelligence, as I understand the meaning of intelligence. Will they give us that time to converse, do you think?
We must hope that there are more like Gaynor.
An odd thing to hope. Eh, Whiskers?
Apparently Whiskers does not understand its master's joke.
Gah!
Jari bowed to the wind.
I shall assume that the wind is showing its appreciation.
Coram clutched his fur robe to him. Though it had been ripped in several places by the hounds of Kerenos, it was still serviceable.
Come, let us cross the plain of Craig Doan.
The snow was in constant movement beneath their horses' feet, eddying like an agitated river over rocks. The wind blew it this way and that, causing the snowdrifts to heave and fall and reform. The wind drove into their bones, so that sometimes they felt they would rather have cold steel in them than that wind. The wind sighed like a huntsman satisfied by his kill. The wind moaned like a satiated lover. The wind growled like a hungry beast. The wind shouted like a conqueror, and it hissed like a striking snake. It blew fresh snow from the sky. Their shoulders would be heaped with this snow until it was blown clear again and a new deposit laid in its place. The wind blew roads through the snow for them and then sealed them up again. The wind blew from the east and from the north and from the west and from the south. Sometimes it seemed that the wind blew from all directions at once, seeking to crush them as they pressed on across the plain of Craigdone. The wind built castles and it tore them down. The wind whispered promises and roared threats. The wind toyed with them. Then, through the swirl and confusion, Coram saw dark shapes ahead.
Warriors! Coram, our horses will be no help to us in this depth of snow.
Coram dismounted and sank to his knees in the stuff. Jari remained on horseback, however.
Fear not, Coram. They are not men. They are stones. They are the stones of Craigdone.
And Coram realized that he had misjudged the distance, that the objects were still some good distance ahead.
This is the holy place of the Mabdon.
This is where they elect their high kings and hold their important ceremonies.
It is where they once did these things.
They approached the great stones.
Even the wind seems to show reverence for this great old place.
There were 7 circles in all, each circle containing another, until the center was reached, and the inner circle contained a large stone altar. Coram looked out from the center and down the hill.
I fancy these stone circles represent ripples upon a pool, planes of reality, representations of a geometry not wholly connected with earthly geometry. It is a holy place. It is.
Agreed. Certainly it touches upon something I cannot explain. Does it not remind you in some ways of Tanalorn?
Tanalorn? Perhaps. Is this their Tanalorn?
Geographically speaking, I think it might be. Tanalorn is not always a city. Sometimes it is a thing. Sometimes it is merely an idea. And this... this is the representation of an idea.
So primitive in its materials and the working of those materials, yet so subtle in its conception. What minds created Craigdone, I wonder?
Mabdon minds, those you serve. This too is why they cannot bring themselves to unite against the Foy Miore. This was the center of their world. It reminded them of their faith and their dignity. Now that they can no longer come upon their 2 great yearly visits to Craigdon, their souls starve, and starving rob them of their strength of will.
We must find a means of giving Craigdon back to them, then.
But first, give them their High King, he who possesses all the wisdom of those who spend whole weeks fasting and meditating at Craigdon's altar. Or so they say.
Jari leaned against one of the great stone pillars, as if embarrassed by having been caught uttering an approving word for the place.
Not that it is my affair. I mean if...
Look who comes, and he appears to come alone.
It was Gaynor. He had arrived at the outer circle of stones and seemed so small at that distance that he could only be identified by his armor, which, as usual, constantly changed color. He was not on horseback. He came walking through what was almost a tunnel made up of 7 great arches until he was within earshot.
Some would have it that this temple, this Craigdone, is a representation of the million spheres, of the various planes of existence. But I do not think the local people sophisticated enough to understand such matters, do you?
Sophistication is not always measured by an ability to forge good steel or build large cities, Prince Gaynor.
Indeed, no. I'm sure that you are right. I've known worlds where the complexity of the natives' thought was equaled only by the squalor of their living conditions.
The faceless helm turned to look up at the boiling sky. Coram's hand rested upon the hilt of his sword.
More snow coming, I'd say. What do you think?
Have you been here long, Prince Gaynor?
On the contrary, you seem to have preceded me. I've just arrived.
But you knew we should be here.
I guessed this was your destination.
Interesting. Gaynor is wrong. This is not our destination. But does Gaynor know a secret concerning Craigdone? A secret which might be to the advantage of the Mabdon?
This place seems to be free of wind. At least, it is freer than the plain itself. And no signs of the Foy Miore in Craig Doan itself.
Of course not! That is why you sought its sanctuary. You hope to understand why the Foy Miore fear it. You think you can find a means of defeating them here. I knew that was your quest!
Corum restrained a secret smile.
Without realizing it, Gaynor has betrayed his masters. You are clever, Prince Gaynor.
Gaynor had come to a stop under an arch in the third circle. He moved no closer.
Your dogs fear this place, too.
Aye. They are Foy Miore dogs. Come with them from Limbo. Their instincts warn them against Craig Doan. Only she and mortals, even mortals such as I, can come here. And I fear the place too, though I've little reason for my fears. The Vortex cannot swallow Gaynor the Damned.
Corum restrained his impulse to ask Prince Gaynor further questions.
I cannot let him know that I had not, until just now, any hint of Craig Doan's properties. Yet you too, Gaynor, are from Limbo. I cannot understand why the Vortex does not claim you.
Limbo is not my natural home. I was banished there. Banished by you, Corum. Only those who came originally from Limbo need fear Craig Doan. But what you think to gain from coming here, I know not. As naive as ever, Corum, you doubtless hoped that the Foy Miore knew nothing of Craig Doan and would follow you here. Well, my friend, I must tell you that my masters, while apparently stupid in some matters, have a proper regard for this place. There would not come an inch within the outer circle. Your journey has been for nothing. Only once were your she ancestors successful in luring their foes to this place. Only once did the Foy Miore warriors find themselves engulfed and drawn back to Limbo. And that was many centuries ago. The remaining Foy Miore are beast-like. They keep a safe distance from Craig Doan, barely realizing why they do so.
They would not rather return to their own realm.
They do not understand that that is where they would go. And it is scarcely in the interest of those like me who do know to try to communicate this knowledge to them. I have no wish to be abandoned here without their protecting power.
So, my journey has been fruitless.
Aye. Moreover, I think it unlikely you'll return to Caer Malod alive. When I go back to Caer Lud, I shall tell them I've seen their she-foe. Then all the hounds will come. All the hounds, Cora. I suggest you remain here where you are safe. Stay in this sanctuary. There is nowhere else in this land that you can escape the Foy Miore and the hounds of Kerenos.
Corum pretended to miss Gaynor's meaning.
But we have food only for a while. We should starve here, Gaynor.
Possibly. On the other hand, I could come from time to time with food when it pleased me. You could live for years, Corum. You could experience something of what I felt when I enjoyed my banishment in Limbo.
So that is what you hope for. That is why you did not harry us on our way here.
As Jari O'Connell began to descend the hill towards Prince Gaynor, curved blade in hand, Gaynor retreated slowly.
No, Jari! You cannot harm him, but he can slay you.
It will be pleasant. It will be pleasant to see you squabbling for the scraps I bring. It will be pleasant to see your friendship die as hunger grows. Perhaps I'll bring you a hound's corpse. One that you slew, Jari O'Connell, eh? Would that be tasty? Or perhaps you will begin to find human flesh wholesome. Which one of you will first begin to desire to slay and eat the other?
This is an ignoble vengeance that you take, Gaynor.
It was an ignoble fate you sent me to, Corum. Besides, I do not claim nobility of spirit. That is your province, is it not? I will leave the dogs I am sure you'll appreciate their company.
Quorum watched Gaynor until he had reached the outer circle and climbed onto his horse.
It is as if the wind wishes to enter the seven stone rings, but cannot.
Jari sheathed his scimitar and stalked back towards Quorum.
So, Jari, we have gained something from the encounter. Craig Doan is more than a holy place. It is a place of great power, an opening between the 15 planes, perhaps. Or even more. We were right to be reminded of Tanalorn. But how is the gateway formed? What ritual opens it? Perhaps the High King will know.
Aye. We have, as you say, gained something, Quorum, but we have lost something too. How are we to reach the High King now? Listen.
The Hounds of Kerenos are ranging about the outer stone circle.
If we ride from the sanctuary of Craig Don, the dogs will instantly be upon us.
Quorum drew his fur cloak about him and squatted by the altar, while Jari O'Connell paced back and forth. The horses nervously pricked their ears for the hounds as evening settled upon the place of the seven stone circles.
It seems to become even colder. Evening shall set in soon.
Craig Don's properties might protect us from the Foy Miore and the hounds, but they cannot protect us from the marrow chilling cold.
Neither are there materials here from which we can build a fire. We took them before, Jari.
And neither you nor your horse looked the better for it. And that was first thing in the morning, when both of you were fresh. I do not like our chances now, unless you have better weapons.
How I wish that I had brought my bow and my arrows upon this quest. But I do have.
Quorum ran to his horse and retrieved his lance.
Quorum, that is one lance.
Quorum's only response was to drop the lance to the snowy ground so that he could search through one of the panniers containing provisions.
Perhaps you can kill one hound at most. But then you have lost your weapon. Unless you happen to have several weapons that you do not mind hurling away and losing.
I have something better.
Rope? Do you intend to harness all the hounds of Kerenos?
We only need to harness the lance, Jari.
Impressive indeed.
Night came down. They stood between two of the great stone pillars of Craig Doan and faced the prowling devil dogs of the Foy Miore. The hounds of Kerenos were both fierce and wary, but they gave the stone circle wide clearance. Others of the dogs sat some distance off, barely visible against the wind-swirled snow which ruffled their shaggy coats.
From somewhere, Gaynor added five more hounds.
Quorum narrowed his eyes and fixed them on the nearest dog. Then he drew back his arm, which held the long and heavy lance, shifted his feet a little to get the best balance, and hurled the weapon with all the force of his fear, his anger, and his desperation. The lance flew true, driving deep into the canine body, knocking the hound from its feet.
Now, Jari!
Jari O'Connell held the end of the rope and began to tug. Quorum pulled too. The line had been securely attached to the lance, and the lance was buried deep in the dog's body, so that this too was dragged back into the sanctuary of the stone circle. The hound tried to snap at the shaft of the lance, but then it had been pulled under the arch, and it became suddenly supine, as if it accepted its doom.
Hurrah!
Quorum and Jari O'Connell were jubilant. Putting his booted foot on the carcass, Quorum jerked his lance free, and they immediately ran back to the arch, selecting a fresh target. He struck a second hound in the throat, and instantly dragged the lance back. This time the lance came free from the corpse and bounced back through the snow to them.
Now there are six beasts left,
but they have become more wary. Oh, that I had my bow and arrows!
A hound came forward and sniffed at the corpse of its fellow. It nuzzled the throat from where the fresh blood poured. It began to lap the blood with its long red tongue.
This third hound shall pay dearly for its meal.
The lance sprang out again from between the tall columns and plunged into the hound's left flank. The hound whirled and tried to get free, fell writhing into the blood-flecked snow, rose again, and wrenched itself away, leaving a large part of its flank on the head of the spear. It ran in circles for a while as its lifeblood gushed from it, and then, about 100 yards from the corpse it had only recently been feeding from, it flopped down. Feeling that they were at a safe distance from the deadly lance, its brother hounds moved in and began to feast off its still-living flesh. Quorum and Jari ran to their horses and hastily mounted.
It is our one great advantage that the Hounds of Keranos possess no moral sense concerning the eating of their fellows. It is their weakness, I think.
Then, while the hounds slavered around their feast, Coram and Jari O'Connell rode back through the Seven Circles, past the carved stone altar at the center of the first circle, out again through the circles, until they were on the far side from the hounds.
The hounds have not yet guessed our plan. There are a few minutes in hand.
Digging their heels deep into the flanks of their horses, they galloped as fast as they could away from Crag Don, heading not for Kaia Mallard, as Gaynor would think they did, but for their original destination of Kaia Lewd.
With any luck, the wind will obscure our tracks and spread our scent in all directions.
Which would buy us time to reach Kaia Lewd and find Emergan the Archdruid before Gaynor or the Foy Miore have any hint of our plan.
Gaynor had spoken the truth when he had told them that they could never reach Kaia Mallard with all the Hounds of Keranos hunting for them. But when Gaynor found them gone, it was almost certain that for a while he would waste time riding in the wrong direction while his dogs cast for their scent. But Gaynor's jaundiced view of mortal character had worked this time to his disadvantage. He had reckoned without the quick thinking of Coram and Jari O'Connell, without their determination or their willingness to risk their lives for a cause. He had spent too long in the company of the weak, the greedy, and the decadent. Doubtless he preferred such company, since he shone in it. As he rode, Coram considered what he had learned from Gaynor the Damned. Did Crag Don still possess the properties Gaynor had described, or had they only worked for the Shi? Was Crag Don now only a shell, avoided by the Foy Miore out of superstition, rather than knowing respect for its powers? He hoped that there would come a time when he could discover the truth for himself. If Crag Don was still truly a place of power, there might be a way found to make use of it again. The pillars of Crag Don grew to black shadows in the distance, and then were obscured entirely by the swirling snow.
But now I must forget Crag Don. I must think ahead of Kaer Lewd, an American, under a glamour in his tower by the river, guarded both by men and things which are not men.
They were cold and they were hungry. The coats of their horses were rimed, and their own cloaks sparkled with frost.
I cannot feel my face anymore, Coram. It has been numbed by the cold wind.
So is mine. My body aches whenever I move.
As does mine.
But we have found Kaer Lewd.
From their perch upon a hill, they saw a wide, frozen river. On both banks of the river, and connected by well-constructed wooden bridges, was the city of the High King. Pale granite, coated with snow, some of the buildings rising several stories. For this world, it was a large city, perhaps the largest, and must once have contained a population of 20,000 or 30,000. But now the city had the appearance of having been abandoned, for all that shapes could be seen moving through the mist which hung in its streets. The mist was everywhere. Thinner in some places, it clung to Kaer Lewd like a threadbare shroud.
I recognize that mist. It is Foy Miore mist.
You fear that mist?
I fear the primitive power of the surviving lords of Limbo.
Even as they watched, he saw a movement where the mist was thickest, close to the riverbank. He saw a suggestion of a dark horned head, of a gigantic torso, which faintly resembled the body of a toad, of the outlines of a huge creaking cart drawn by something as oddly formed as the rider. Then it had gone.
Keranos!
He who is master to the hounds?
And master of much more.
Jari took a large linen rag from under his jerkin.
I fear this weather affects my health badly. I would not mind coming to blows with some of those who created such weather.
We are not strong enough, you and I. We must wait. We must be as careful to avoid conflict with the Foy Miore as Gaynor is in avoiding direct conflict with me.
Coram peered through the mist and the eddying snow.
Kaer Lewd is not guarded.
Plainly they fear no attack from the Mablin. Why should they?
That is to our advantage. Your face is blue with cold, Jari.
As is yours.
I think we'd both pass for living corpses if we entered Kaer Lewd now. If stopped, we shall announce that we are Foy Miore men.
While it is impossible to reason either with the Foimiore or their slaves because of their primitive mentalities, it also means that they are slow to recognize a deception. Come!
If Corum and Jaria Conal had considered themselves cold, it was now as nothing to the totality of coldness in which they now found themselves. The mist seemed virtually sentient, eating into their flesh, their bones, and their vitals, so that they were hard put not to cry out and reveal their ordinary humanity. For Gaynor the Damned, for the Golech, the living dead, for the Brothers of the Pines like Hugh Argech, whom Corum had once fought, such cold doubtless meant little. But for mortals of the conventional mold, it meant a great deal. With set faces, they rode on, avoiding the worst of the mist as best they could, seeking the great tower by the river, where they hoped Amergin was still imprisoned. They said little as they rode, finding speech painful, and fearing to reveal their identities, for it was impossible to know who or what lurked on either side of them in the mist.
The horse has become sluggish, Corum. This dreadful mist affects them too.
There is a house just to the left of us which seems empty. See, the door is open. Ride directly through.
And he turned his own horse into the doorway and entered a narrow passage already occupied by an old woman and a girl child who were huddled together, frozen and dead. Corum led his horse into a room off the passage.
Well, the room appears to be untouched by looters.
A glaze of frost covered food on the table, which had been set for some 10 people. A few spears stood in a corner, and there were shields and swords against the wall.
The men of the house went to fight the Foimiore.
And never returned for their meal.
The old woman and the girl in the hall most likely died beneath the influence of Balar's frightful eye.
And doubtless we will find the corpses of others, old or young, who did not join the battle against the Foimiore when they first came to Kaer-Lude.
How desperately I wish to light a fire to warm my aching bones.
Aye, but you know it would be risking too much, Corum.
The living dead do not need fires to warm them, and neither do the people of the pines.
Jaria Conal drew his cat from within his jerkin.
There will be clothing upstairs, perhaps blankets. I will see.
The small black and white cat was already climbing back inside Jari's jacket. Corum cautiously climbed a wooden staircase and found himself on a narrow landing. As he had guessed, there were others here. Two very old men and three babies.
The old men died, trying to give their body heat to the children.
Corum entered a room and found a large cupboard full of blankets.
Stiff with cold, but not frozen through.
He dragged out as many as he could carry and took them back down the stairs.
You are truly a worthy hero to be a companion to, Corum.
Jari seized the blankets and began to drape them around his shoulders. Corum also draped their horses. As Jari huddled in a mound of blankets, Corum unwrapped something from his waist.
Corum, what is that nondescript mantle you've been carrying with you? I have long considered it, and find your choices of clothing most peculiar.
It is the gift of King Fiacha. It is a she-cloak. I have a plan. You will wait here with the horses, Jari, while I seek Amergin with the help of this.
Corum unfolded the mantle, wondering again as it hid his hands from his own sight. Jari stared.
Oh, I now consider it a very fine garment indeed.
Cautiously, Corum peered through a crack in the shuttered windows. Through the clinging mist he saw shapes moving, many shapes. Some were on foot and some were mounted, but all were of the same greenish hue. The horses they rode were also of the same strange green colour, and Corum recognized them.
It is the Brothers to the Pines, strange creatures who were once men, but now have sap instead of blood in their veins. They draw their vitality not from meat and drink, but from the earth itself. They are the Foimiore's fiercest fighters and their most intelligent slaves. And yet even these are doomed when the Foimiore poison all the earth so that even the hardy trees can no longer live.
But by that time, the Foimiore will no longer need their green warriors.
These are the creatures of whom I am most wary, with the exception of Gaynor himself, for they still retain much of their former intellect.
he motioned Jari to complete silence and barely breathed as he watched the throng pass by.
Ah, that is a large army, and it has prepared itself for an expedition.
And it is leaving Kaer-Lud, it seems.
But is it to make a further attack on Kaer-Malet, or do they march elsewhere?
And then, behind this army, swam a thicker mist. The mist thinned a fraction, and Quorum saw the outline of lumbering, malformed beasts and a wicker chariot. He had to peer upward to see the faint outline of the one who rode in the chariot. He saw reddish fur, saw an eight-fingered hand, all gnarled and covered in warts, clutching what appeared to be a monstrous hammer, but the shoulders and the head were completely obscured. Quorum wrapped the she-cloak about his body. It seemed to have been made for a much larger man, for its folds completely engulfed him. And then it seemed, to his astonishment, that he saw two rooms, as if his eyes were slightly out of focus. Yet the rooms were subtly different. One was the room of death in which Jari sat huddled in his blankets, and one was light, airy, full of sunshine. And Quorum understood, then, the properties of the she-cloak.
It has been a long time since I was able to shift my body from one plane to another.
Effectively, this was what the mantle had done for him. Like Hybrasail, it was not completely of this plane. It moved him sideways, as it were, through the dimensions separating one plane from another. Jari Aconal peered in Quorum's direction.
Quorum, what has happened? Why, have I vanished? No, but you have become a little shadowy, as if the mist thickens around you.
So the cloak does not work after all. I should have tested it before I left Kaer-Malet.
Perhaps it will deceive Mabdanai's, Quorum. You forget that I am used to travelling between the realms, but those who cannot see, who have no knowledge such as we possess, perhaps they will not see you.
Well, we must hope so, Jari, for I must go seek the tower by the river now.
Go warily, Quorum. Gaenor, and the four Imiore themselves, many are not of this world at all. Some may see you clearly. Others may gain just an impression of your outline. But there is much danger in what you plan.
As Quorum went through the open gateway and began to ascend the gently rising steps which led to the entrance of the tall granite tower, the Golech stood directly in Quorum's path. He was big, barrel-chested, clad in leather, and in each white hand he held a cutlass. His red eyes glared, his bloodless lips curved in something which could have been a smile or a snarl.
I have met his kind before.
This was one of the Foemiore's living dead vassals. Often they rode as huntsmen with the hounds of Keranos, for they were drawn from the ranks of those who had been foresters before the Foemiore came.
This must be the test.
He stood less than a foot from the red-eyed Golech, and assumed a martial position, one hand on his sword. But the Golech did not respond. He continued to stare through Quorum.
He plainly cannot see me.
In some relief, his faith in the she-cloak restored, Quorum passed around the Golech guard and continued until he reached the entrance to the tower itself. Here stood two more Golech, and they were as unaware of Quorum's presence as their fellow. He was almost cheerful as he walked through and began to mount the curving stairway leading up into the heart of the tower. The tower was wide and roughly square in shape. The steps were old and worn, and the walls on both sides were either painted or carved with pictures of exceptionally beautiful workmanship. As with most Mabdan art, they depicted famous deeds, great heroes, love stories, and the doings of gods and demigods. Yet they had a purity of conception, a beauty, which showed none of the darker aspects of superstition and religiosity. The metaphorical content of the old stories was completely understood by these Mabdan, and appreciated for what it was. Here and there were the remains of tapestries which had been torn from the walls. Frost-coated, mist-rotted as they were, it was possible to see that they had been of immeasurable value, worked in gold and silver thread, as well as rich scarlets, yellows, and blues.
What destruction the Foemiore and their minions have wrought!
He reached the first story of the tower, and found himself on a wide stone-flagged landing, almost a room in itself, with benches lined along the walls, and decorative shields set above them.
That will do nicely, thank you.
Confident now in the powers of his cloak, he approached the half-open door and to his surprise felt warmth issuing from it. He was grateful for the warmth, but puzzled too. Becoming more cautious, he peered round the door and was shocked. Two figures sat beside a big fire which had been built in the stone hearth. Both were swathed in layers of thick white fur. Both wore fur gauntlets.
Both have no business being in Kyrlude at all.
On the other side of the room, food was being set out by a girl who had the same white flesh and red eyes of the Golech guards, and was doubtless, like them, one of the living dead.
So they are obviously not in Kyrlude illicitly. They are guests with servants put at their disposal.
One of these guests of the Foemiore was a tall, slender Mabdin with jeweled rings on his gloved hands and a jeweled golden collar at his throat. His long hair and his long beard were both grey, framing a handsome old face. And worn by a thong passed over his head so that it rested upon his chest was a horn. It was a long horn, and there were bands of silver and gold around it. Coram knew that every one of those bands represented a different forest beast. The Mabdin was the one he had met near Moidel's Mount, and with whom he had traded a cloak. A cloak in exchange for the horn, which the Mabdin had apparently recovered.
Kaladin.
It was the wizard who planned secret plans which had nothing to do with loyalty, either to his Mabdin countrymen or their Foemiore enemies, or so Coram had thought. But still more shocking to Coram was the sight of the wizard's companion.
He swore he would never involve himself in the affairs of the world.
And this man must truly be a renegade, for it was the one who was self-called a dwarf, yet was 8 feet tall and at least 4 feet broad at the shoulder, who had the fine, sensitive features which marked him as a cousin to the Varrach, for all but much of those features were covered in black hair. There was a glimpse of an iron breastplate beneath his many furs. There were polished iron greaves with gold inlays on his legs, and he wore an iron, polished helmet of similar workmanship. Beside him stood his huge, double-bladed war axe, not unlike Coram's axe, but much larger. This was Gofanon, the she-smith of High Braesail, who had given Coram the spear Brionac and the bag of spittle which Kaladin had wanted.
How could Gofanon possibly ally himself with the Foemiore, let alone the wizard Kaladin? Did he deceive me? Was he in league with the Foemiore and Kaladin all along? Yet if so, why did he give me the spear Brionac?
Now, as if he sensed Coram's presence, Gofanon slowly began to turn his head towards the door. And Coram withdrew hastily behind the door, not sure if the she would be able to see him. There was something strange about Gofanon's face, something dull and tragic. But Coram had not had enough time to study the expression closely enough to be able to analyze it. With heavy heart, horrified by Gofanon's treachery, though not overly surprised by Kaladin's decision to league himself with the Foemiore, Coram tiptoed back to the landing.
We shall go with them tomorrow when they march.
Now begins in earnest the conquest of the West.
So, the Foemiore do prepare for battle, and almost certainly they march against Kaer Malad again. And this time they have a she as an ally, and no she weapons to thwart their ambitions.
Coram moved with greater urgency up the next stairway, and had gone halfway when he turned a bend and saw a lump squatting so that it filled the whole stair and afforded him no room through which he could pass undetected. The lump did not see him, but it lifted its snout. Its three eyes, of disparate size, had a puzzled look. Its pink, bristle-covered flesh quivered as it pushed itself into a sitting position on its five arms. Three of the arms were human, seeming to have belonged to a woman, a youth, and an old man. One of the arms was simian, that of a gorilla, and one of the arms seemed to have been the property of some kind of large reptile. The legs, which the lump now revealed, were short and ended in a human foot, a cloven hoof, and a dog-like paw, respectively. The lump was naked, apparently sexless, and it was unarmed. As silently as possible, Coram drew his sword as the three lids closed over the three mismatched eyes, and the lump, seeing nothing, resettled itself to sleep again. He struck through the oval mouth, through the roof of the mouth, into the brain. The eyes opened, and instantly one closed again, in a kind of obscene wink. The others stared at the blade of the sword in astonishment, for it seemed to protrude from the thin air. The simian hand came up to touch the blade, but it never completed the gesture. The hand fell limply back. The remaining eyes closed. Korum clambered over the fat, yielding flesh as fast as he could.
I pray that no one finds the lump's corpse before I can discover the whereabouts of the Archdruid American.
There were two Golech guards, their cutlasses at attention across their chests, at the top of this particular stair, but it was plain that they had heard nothing. Hurriedly, Korum slipped past them and mounted the next flight. And there on the landing above him, he saw two huge hounds.
The largest of all the hounds of Keranos I have ever seen.
They could not see him, but they had caught his scent. Acting as rapidly as he had acted when he had seen the lump, Korum ran through the gap between the dogs and had the satisfaction of seeing them almost close their fangs on each other's throats. And here was a great archway filled by a door of beaten bronze on which had been raised motifs of beautiful complexity.
King Fiacha described this. This is the door to American's apartments.
And hanging on a brass hook beside the door, beside the head of one gigantic Golech guard, was a single iron key. And this was the key to the beautiful bronze door.
The hounds must have been ordered not to leave their position.
The Golech guard's dull features became curious. He lurched forward.
What is it, dogs? The strangers come.
Korum stepped behind the Golech and drew the key from its hook. Korum found himself in an apartment full of rich, dark hangings. The apartment was warm too, heated by a fire even larger than the one at which Kalatin and Gofanon sat two floors below.
New-cut grass. But where is American?
Stealthily, Korum crept from one dark room to another, his hand on his sword, expecting some new trap. And then at last, he saw something. At first, he took it for an animal, for it was upon all fours and eating from a golden tray piled high with the strands of some vegetable. The head turned, but the eyes did not see Korum, still draped in his she-mantle. Large, soft eyes stared at nothing, and the jaws moved slowly as they chewed the vegetation. The body was clothed in sheepskin garments with the wool still on them. The wool was dirty and full of filthy scraps of thistle, briar, and burrs, as if torn from the body of a wild mountain sheep. Jacket, shirt, and leggings were all of the same coarse stuff, and there was even a hood of sheepskin drawn around the head, exposing only the face. The man looked ridiculous and pathetic.
This is American, High King of the Mabden, and he truly is under a glamour.
It had been a handsome face, possibly an intelligent face, but now it was neither. The eyes stared unblinking into nothing.
American?
He began to crawl towards the shadows, where doubtless he thought he would find security.
Oh, I am sorry, High King.
Without hesitation, Korum reversed his grip upon his sword and brought the round pommel down hard on the back of American's neck. Then he picked up the body and heaved it over his shoulder.
His body is so light. The man is slowly starving to death on this diet of grass.
Somehow he managed to drape his mantle over Amergen's body as well as his own, checking in a mirror that both he and Amergen were invisible. He kept his sword still in his hand, though also covered by his mantle.
King Fiacha said there would be little chance of releasing Amergen from his enchantment until we are far away from Kaerlud. I will simply have to carry the Archdruid to safety.
Cautiously, he peered onto the landing. The Golech was still standing close to the hounds. Both of the devil dogs remained nervous, suspicious, but were still seated, their heads coming almost to the Golech's shoulder.